The storm was resting. It didn't want to be, but it was. It had spent a fortnight understudying a famous anticyclone over the Circle Sea, turning up every day, hanging around in the cold front, grateful for a chance to uproot the occasional tree or whirl a farmhouse to any available emerald city of its choice. But the big break in the weather had never come. It consoled itself with the thought that even the really great storms of the past, the Great Gale of 1789, for example, or Hurricane Zelda and her amazing raining frogs, had gone through this sort of thing at some stage in their career. It was just part of the great tradition of the weather. Besides, it had had a good stretch in the equivalent of pantomime down on the plains, bringing seasonal snow and terminal frostbite to millions. It just had to be philosophical about being back up here now with nothing much to do except wave the heather about. If weather was people, this storm would be filling in time wearing a cardboard hat and a hamburger hell. Currently, it was observing three figures moving slowly over the moor, converging with some determination on a bare patch where the standing stone stood, or usually stood, though just at the moment it wasn't visible. It recognised them as old friends and connoisseurs, and conjured up a brief, unseasonal roll of thunder as a form of greeting. This was totally ignored.
"The bloody stone's gone," said Granny Weatherwax, "however many there is of it."
Her face was pale. It might also have been drawn. If so, then it was by a very neurotic artist. She looked as though she meant business, bad business.
"Light the fire, Magrat," she added automatically.
"I dare say we'll all feel better for a cup of tea," said Nanny Ogg, mouthing the words like a mantra.
She fumbled in the recesses of her shawl.
"With something in it," she added, producing a small bottle of applejack.
"Alcohol is a deceiver and tarnishes the soul," said Magrat virtuously.
"I never touch the stuff," said Granny Weatherwax. "We should keep a clear head, Gaither."
"Just a drop in your tea isn't drinking," said Nanny. "It's medicine. It's a chilly old wind up here, sisters."
"Very well," said Granny, "but just a drop."
They drank in silence. Eventually Granny said,
"Well, Magrat, you know all about this coven business. We might as well do it right. What do we do next?"
Magrat hesitated. She wasn't up to suggesting dancing naked. "There's a song," she said, "in praise of the full moon."
"It ain't full," Granny pointed out. "It's, what's name? Bulging."
"Gibbous," said Nanny obligingly.
"I think it's in praise of full moons in general," Magrat hazarded. "And then we have to raise our consciousness. It really ought to be full moon for that, I'm afraid. Moons are very important." Granny gave her a long, calculating look.
"That's modern witchcraft for you, is it?"
she said. "It's part of it, Granny. There's a lot more." Granny Weatherwax sighed.
"Each to her own, I suppose. I'm blowed if I'll let a ball of shiny rock tell me what to do."
"Yes, bugger all that," said Nanny. "Let's curse somebody."
The fool crept cautiously along the nighttime corridors. He wasn't taking any chances either. Magrat had given him a graphic account of Grebo's general disposition, and the fool had borrowed a couple of gloves and a sort of metal wimple from the castle's store of hereditary chainmail. He reached the lumber room, lifted the latch cautiously, pushed the door, and then flung himself against the wall. The corridor became slightly darker as the more intense darkness inside the room spilled out and mingled with the rather lighter darkness already there. Apart from that, nothing. The number of spitting, enraged balls of murderous fur pouring out through the door was zero. The fool relaxed and slipped inside. Grebo dropped on his head. It had been a long day. The room did not offer the kind of full life that Grebo had come to expect and demand. The only point of interest had been the discovery, around mid-morning, of a colony of mice who had spent generations eating their way through a priceless tapestry history of Loncra and had just got as far as King Murren, 7:09 to 7:45, who met a terrible fate. When they did, too. King Murren's fate involved a red-hot poker, a privy, 10 pounds of live eels, a 3-mile stretch of frozen river, a butt of wine, a couple of tulip bulbs, a number of poisoned eardrops, an oyster, and a large man with a mallet. King Murren didn't make friends easily. Gribo had sharpened his claws on a bust of Loncre's only royal vampire, Queen Grimnir, the Impaler. 1514 to 1553. 1553 to 1557. 1557 to 1562. 1562 to 1567. And 1568 to 1573. He had performed his morning ablutions on a portrait of an unknown monarch, which was beginning to dissolve. Now he was bored and also angry. He raked his claws across the place where the fool's ears should have been, and was rewarded with nothing more than a metallic scraping noise. "Who's a good boy, then?" said the fool.
"Wazza, wazza, whoosh."
This intrigued Gribo. The only other person who had ever spoken to him like this was Nanny Ogg. Everyone else addressed him as,
"Yeah, get out of it, you bastard."
He leaned down very carefully, intrigued by the new experience. From the fool's point of view, an upside-down cat face lowered itself slowly into his field of vision, wearing an expression of evil-eyed interest.
"Does it want to come home, then?"
said the fool hopefully. "Look, Mr. Door is open." Gribo increased his grip. He had found a friend. The fool shrugged very carefully, turned, and walked back into the passage. He made his way down through the hall, out into the courtyard, around the side of the guardroom, and out through the main gate, nodding carefully to the guards.
"Man just went past with a cat on his head,"
one of them remarked after a minute or two's reflection.
"See who it was?" "The fool, I think."
There was a thoughtful pause. The second guard shifted his grip on his habard.
"It's a rotten job," he said, "but I suppose someone's got to do it." "We ain't going to curse anyone," said Granny firmly. "It hardly ever works if they don't know you've done it. What you do is, you send him a doll of himself with pins in. No, Gaither. All you have to do is get hold of some of his toenails,"
Nanny persisted enthusiastically.
"No. Or some of his hair or anything. I've got some pins." "No."
"Cursing people is morally unsound and extremely bad for your karma," said McGrath.
"Well, I'm going to curse him anyway," said Nanny. "Under my breath, like. I could have caught my death in that dungeon for all he cared." "We ain't going to curse him," said Granny. "We're going to replace him. What did you do with the old king?"
"I left the rock on my kitchen table," said Nanny.
"I couldn't stand it any more."
"I don't see why," said McGrath. "He seemed very pleasant. For a ghost?"
"Oh, he was all right. It was the others," said Nanny.
"Others? Pray, carry a stone out of the palace so's I can haunt it, good mother, he says
Nanny Ogg.
"It's bloody boring in here, Mistress Ogg, excuse my clatchian," he says. "So, of course, I did. I reckon they were all listening. Oh, yes. They all thinks, 'All aboard, time for a bit of a holiday.' I've nothing against ghosts, especially royal ghosts," she added loyally, "but my cottage isn't the place for them. I mean, there's some woman in a chariot yelling her head off in the washroom, I ask you, and there's a couple of little kiddies in the pantry, and men without heads all over the place, and someone screaming under the sink, and there's this little hairy man wandering around lost and everything. It's not right."
"Just so long as he's not here," said Granny. "We don't want any men around."
"He's a ghost, not a man," said McGrath.
"'We don't have to go into details,' Granny said icily.
"'But you can't put the old king back on the throne,' said Magrat. "'Ghosts can't rule. You'd never get the crown to stay on. It'd drop through.'
"'We're going to replace him with his son,' said Granny. "'Proper succession.'
"'Oh, we've been through all that,' said Nanny dismissively.
"'In about 15 years' time, perhaps, but tonight,' said Granny.
"'A child on the throne? He wouldn't last 5 minutes.'
"'Not a child,' said Granny quietly. "'A grown man. Remember Alice Demurrage?'
There was silence. Then Nanny Ogg sat back.
"'Bloody hell!' she whispered. "'You ain't gonna try that, are you?'
"'I mean to have a go.'
"'Bloody hell!'
said Nanny again, very quietly, and added,
"'You've been thinking about this, have you?'
"'Yes.'
"'See here, Esme, I mean, Black Alice was one of the best. I mean, you're very good at, well, headology and thinking and that. I mean, Black Alice, well, she just upped and went at it.'
"'You saying I couldn't do it, are you?'
"'Excuse me,' said Magrat. "'No, no, of course not,' said Nanny, ignoring her.
"'Right.
Only, well... She was a, you know, a hoyden of witches, like the king said.
Doyen,
said Granny, who had looked it up.
Not hoyden.
Excuse me, said Magrat, louder this time. Who was Black Alice? And, she added quickly, none of this exchanging meaningful glances and talking over my head. There's 3 witches in this coven, remember?
She was before your time, said Nanny Ogg. Before mine, really. She lived over Scund way. Very powerful witch. If you listen to rumour, said Granny. She turned a pumpkin into a royal coach once, said Nanny.
Showy,
said Granny Weatherwax.
That's no help to anyone, turning up at a ball smelling like a pie, and that business with the glass slipper, dangerous to my mind.
But the biggest thing she ever did, said Nanny, ignoring the interruption, was to send a whole palace to sleep for 100 years until...
She hesitated.
Can't remember. Was the rose bushes involved, or was it spinning wheels in that one? I think some princess had to finger... No, there was a prince, that was it.
Finger a prince? Said Magrat uneasily.
No... He had to kiss her. Very romantic, Black Alice was. There was always a bit of romance in her spells. She liked nothing better than girl meets frog.
Why did they call her Black Alice?
Fingernails, said Granny.
And teeth, said Nanny Ogg. She had a sweet tooth, lived in a real gingerbread cottage. Couple of kids shoved her own oven at the end. Shocking.
"'And you're going to send the castle to sleep?' said Magrat.
"'She never sent the castle to sleep,' said Granny. "'That's just an old wives' tale,' she added, glaring at Nanny. "'She just stirred up time a little. "'It's not as hard as people think. "'Everyone does it all the time. "'It's like rubber is time. "'You can stretch it to suit yourself.'
Magrat was about to say, "'That's not right. "'Time is time.' Every second lasts a second. That's what it's for. That's its job. Then she recalled weeks that had flown past, and afternoons that had lasted forever. Some minutes had lasted hours. Some hours had gone past so quickly she hadn't been aware they'd gone past at all.
But that's just people's perception, she said, isn't it?
Oh, yes, said Granny. Of course it is. It all is. What difference does that make?
100 years would be over-egging it, mind, said Nanny.
I reckon 15 would be a nice round number, said Granny. That means the lad will be 18 at the finish. We just do the spell, Go and fetch him. He can manifest his destiny, and everything will be nice and neat.
McGrath didn't comment on this, because it had occurred to her that destinies sounded easy enough when you talked about them, but were never very bankable where real human beings were concerned. But Nanny Ogg sat back and tipped another generous measure of apple brandy in her tea.
"Could work out nice," she said. "A bit of peace and quiet for 15 years. If I recall the spell, after you say it, you have to fly around the castle before cockcrow."
"I wasn't thinking about that," said Granny. "It wouldn't be right. Felmet would still be king all that time. The kingdom would still get sick. No, what I was thinking of doing was moving the whole kingdom."
She beamed at them.
"The whole of Lancre?" said Nanny.
"Yes.
15 years into the future?"
"Yes."
Nanny looked at Granny's broomstick. It was a well-made thing, built to last, apart from the occasional starting problem, but there were limits.
"You'll never do it," she said. "Not around the whole kingdom in that. That's all the way up to Powder Knife and down to Drumlin's Fell. You just couldn't carry enough magic."
"I thought of that," said Granny.
She beamed again. It was terrifying. She explained the plan. It was dreadful. A minute later, the moor was deserted, as the witches hurried to their tasks. It was silent for a while, apart from the squeak of bats and the occasional rustle of the wind in the heather. Then there was a bubbling from the nearby peat bog. Very slowly, crowned with a thicket of sphagnum moss, the standing stone surfaced and peered around the landscape with an air of deep distrust.
Grebo was really enjoying this. At first he thought his new friend was taking him to McGrath's cottage, but for some reason he'd wandered off the path in the dark and was taking a stroll in the forest. In one of the more interesting bits, Grebo had always felt. It was a hummocky area, rich in hidden potholes and small, intense swamps, full of mist, even in fine weather. Grebo often came up here on the off chance that a wolf was lying up for the day.
"I thought cats could find their own way home," the fool muttered.
He cursed himself under his breath. It would have been easy to take this wretched creature back to Nanny Ogg's house, which was only a few streets away, almost in the shadow of the castle. But then he'd had the idea of delivering it to McGrath. It would impress her, he thought. Witches were very keen on cats. And then she'd be bound to ask him in for a cup of tea or something. He put his foot in another water-filled hole. Something wriggled underneath it. The fool groaned and stepped back onto a tumescent mushroom.
"Look, cat," he said. "You've got to come down, right? And then you can find your way home and I'll follow you. Cats are good at seeing in the dark and finding their own way home," he added hopefully.
He reached up. Grebo sank his claws into his arm as a friendly warning, and found, to his surprise, that this had no effect on Chainmail.
"There's a good cat," said the fool, and lowered him to the ground. "Go on, find your way home. Any home will do."
Grebo's grin gradually faded until there was nothing left but the cat. This was nearly as spooky as the opposite way round. He stretched and yawned to hide his embarrassment. Being called a good cat in the middle of one of his favourite stalking grounds wasn't going to do anything for his prowl credibility. He disappeared into the undergrowth. The fool peered into the gloom. It dawned on him that while he liked forests, he liked them at one remove, as it were. It was nice to know that they were there, but the forests of the mind were not quite the same as real forests that, for example, you got lost in. They had more mighty oaks and fewer brambles. They also tended to be viewed in daylight. and the trees didn't have malevolent faces and long scratchy branches. The trees of the imagination were proud giants of the forest. Most of the trees here appeared to be vegetable gnomes, mere trellises for fungi and ivy. The fool was vaguely aware that you could tell which direction the hub lay by seeing which side of the trees the moss grew on. A quick inspection of the nearby trunks indicated that, in defiance of all normal geography, the hub lay everywhere. Gribo had vanished. The fool sighed, removed his chainmail protection, and tinkled gently through the night in search of high ground. High ground seemed a good idea. The ground he was on at the moment appeared to be trembling. He wasn't sure it should do that. McGrath hovered on her broomstick several hundred feet above the turnwise borders of Loncra, looking down on a sea mist through which an occasional treetop poked like a seaweed-covered rock at high tide. A bulging moon floated above her, probably gibbous again. Even a decent thin crescent would have been better, she felt, more appropriate. She shivered, and wondered where Granny Weatherwax was at this moment. The old witch's broomstick was known and feared throughout the skies of Loncra. Granny had been introduced to flying quite late in life, and after some initial suspicion, had taken to it like a blue bottle to an ancient fish head. A problem, however, was that Granny saw every flight simply as a straight line from A to B, and was unable to get alongside the idea that other users of the air might have any rights whatsoever. The flight migration patterns of an entire continent had been changed because of that simple fact. High-speed evolution among local birds had developed a generation that flew on their backs, so that they could keep a watchful eye on the skies. Granny's implicit belief that everything should get out of her way extended to other witches, very tall trees, and, on occasion, mountains. Granny had also browbeaten the dwarfs who lived under the mountains and in fear of their lives into speeding the thing up. Many an egg had been laid in mid-air by unsuspecting fowls who had suddenly glimpsed Granny bearing down on them, scowling over the top of the broomstick. "Oh, dear," thought McGrath. "I hope she hasn't happened to someone." A midnight breeze turned her gently around in the air, like an unsupported weathercock. She shivered, and squinted at the moonlit mountains, the high ramtops, whose freezing crags and ice-green chasms acknowledged no king or cartographer. Only on the Rimwood side was Loncra open to the world. The rest of its borders looked as jagged as a wolf's mouth, and far more impassable. From up here, it was possible to see the whole kingdom. There was a ripping noise in the sky above her, a blast of wind that spun her around again, and a Doppler distorted cry of, "Stop dreaming, girl!" She gripped the bristles with her knees and urged the stick upwards. It took several minutes to catch up with Granny, who was lying almost full length along her broomstick to reduce wind resistance. Dark treetops roared far below them as McGrath came alongside. Granny turned to her, holding her hat on with one hand.
"Not before time," she snapped. "I don't reckon this one's got more'n a few minutes' flight left. Come on, get a move on."
She reached out a hand. So did McGrath. Unsteadily, the broomsticks bucking and dipping in one another's slipstreams, they touched fingertips. McGrath's arm tingled as the power flowed up it. Possibly the first attempt at the in-flight refueling of a broomstick. Granny's broomstick jerked forwards.
"Leave me a bit," shouted McGrath. "I've got to get down."
"Shouldn't be difficult,"
screamed Granny above the noise of the wind.
"I mean get down safely."
"You're a witch, ain't you? By the way, did you bring the cocoa? I'm freezing up here."
McGrath nodded desperately, and with her spare hand passed up a straw bag.
"Right," said Granny. "Well done. See you at Loncra Bridge."
She uncurled her fingers. McGrath whirled away in the buffeting wind, clinging tightly to a broomstick which now, she feared, had about as much buoyancy as a bit of firewood, but certainly wasn't capable of sustaining a full-grown woman against the beckoning fingers of gravity. As she plunged down towards the forest roof, in a long, shallow dive, she reflected that there was possibly something complimentary in the way Granny Weatherwax resolutely refused to consider other people's problems. It implied that, in her considerable opinion, they were quite capable of sorting them out by themselves. Some kind of change spell was probably in order. McGrath concentrated. Well, that seemed to work. Nothing in the sight of mortal man had in fact changed. What McGrath had achieved was a mere adjustment of the mental processes from a bewildered and slightly frightened woman gliding inexorably towards the inhospitable ground to a clear-headed, optimistic and positive-thinking woman who had really got it together, was taking full responsibility for her own life, and in general knew where she was coming from, although, unfortunately, where she was heading had not changed in any way, but she felt a lot better about it. She dug her heels in and forced the broomstick to yield the last dregs of its power in a brief burst, sending it skimming erratically a few feet from the trees. As it sagged again and started to plough a furrow among the midnight leaves, she tensed herself, prayed to whatever gods of the forest might be listening that she would land on something soft, and let go. There are 3,000 known major gods on the disk, and research theologians discover more every week. Apart from the minor gods of rock, tree, and water, there are two that haunt the Ramtops. Hoki, half a man, half a goat, and entirely a bad practical joker, who was banished from Dun Manifestin for pulling the old exploding mistletoe joke on blind Io, chief of all the gods. And also Herne the Hunted, the terrified and apprehensive deity of all small furry creatures whose destiny it is to end their lives as a brief, crunchy squeak. Either could have been candidates for the small miracle which then occurred, for in a forest full of cold rocks, jagged stumps and thorn bushes, McGrath landed on something soft. Granny, meanwhile, was accelerating towards the mountains on the second leg of the journey. She consumed the regrettably tepid cocoa and, with proper environmental consideration, dropped the bottle as she passed over an upland lake. It turned out that McGrath's idea of sustaining food was two rounds of egg and cress sandwiches, with the crusts cut off, and Granny noticed, before the wind whipped it away, a small piece of parsley placed with consideration and care on top of each one. Granny regarded them for some time. Then she ate them. A chasm loomed, still choked with winter snow, like a tiny spark in the darkness, a dot of light against the hugeness of the Ramtops. Granny tackled the maze of the mountains.